First of all, I want to thank the organizers for giving me the chance to talk. So what I'm going to talk about is what I called internal relativity. It's sort of my approach to quantum gravity, and I'm slowly making progress. So the outline of the talk is as follows. So first, I'm going to tell you what I mean by internal relativity, and then the next two steps I want to I'm going to try to convince you that I'm getting something like gravity in this model that from the start doesn't have anything like gravity in it. And then I'm going to continue the long discussion, and I'm going to mention a bunch of points that I think are interesting for the loop quantum gravity community. A lot of them have already been mentioned by Balog this morning, but I'm just going to repeat them. So let me first start with internal relativity. So the point of internal relativity, the basic idea goes back to the time before special relativity was created by Einstein. So this kind of thinking goes back to Lorentz, and basically what he did was he looked at Maxwell's equations. So he said our world is described by Maxwell equations. So what would I actually measure if my physical objects are described by this kind of theory? That was his question. A similar question was phrased by Bell in 87 in a small paper, and the point of the thing is this: that if you look at the field of a point charge like this one, so some spherically symmetric field, if you move that charge, the field will deform. So the image that Lorentz had in his head was that, well, if the fundamental constituents of matter actually react to this, you could argue that rods and clouds actually contract. And so he arrived at what we now call Lorentz transformations. Right? So the point is that it's the physics, it's the physical equations that give you Minkowski space. So Einstein chose a completely different path. But Einstein said, no, there's this light cone structure, and there's this background Minkowski space, and what we do from now on is we construct theories that obey sort of this, that obey this structure, that are Lorentz invariant. So what I want to do, what I call internal relativity, is to say, no, let's do it the other way around. Let's do it like Lorentz did, like Bell did, like people like that did, and see if we can take it further. So the basic question is, that's why I call it internal relativity, is how does the system look from the inside? So if you're an observer and the only thing you have is you have access to the excitations or the physical notions in that system, what do you actually get? That's the question of internal relativity. And so here's what I used to formulate as a conjecture, which is that this has actually something to do with GR. So the point is that if you look at matter, then it has this dual role, right? On the one hand, it's the matter we use to find geometrical notions like length and time and stuff like that. But on the other hand, it's also the stuff that propagates. It's just the matter. And I'm saying that if one actually takes this seriously, if one has a system in which one really takes care of how we actually define geometry and how we take care of this part, then if you do that consistently, then you will actually arrive at the equivalence principle and the Einstein equation. So that's sort of the conjecture, and I'm going to now show you how far I am with that. So the setup that I'm going to present is, so first I'm going to present the setup and then the argument for that, and it's going to be very, very short and crisp. So the setup is this one. We've seen these models. So the basic model is some three-dimensional spin system, say on a lattice. I don't really care about the details. We've seen models like that already a couple of times today. The name of Wen was mentioned a couple of times. The much more interesting example is this quantum gravity model by Fotini, but some Ising model with modification would do. So that's the basic setup. Then let's see there's sort of a level of structure that I want to look at. The first thing is we look at the the ground set of this model. So if you have some spin model like that, then what you can think of is a bunch of spins all pointing in the same direction, and this direction then would be characterized by some theta zero. So this is the value that characterizes the vacuum. So that's the zeros level. So you get your Hamiltonian, you solve it, and you find the ground state. The next thing that is interesting is the one level above that, which is the excitations. So if you solve your model and you find the excitations, then you will get some, I don't know, usually you can't do this, right? Usually this is very hard. So I just wrote down the formula for the simple Ising, for the spin chain. So you get some propagating modes, and if you can, you can solve this energy function. And so that's the next step. And this is what corresponds in our world to what we call elementary particles. So that's the picture I want you to have in mind. So the underlying structure is some spin model, which we have no idea of. What we do see are elementary particles. So these are the excitations of our model. The second level then is bound states of excitations. So these are, if our elementary particles are like electrons and protons and all that stuff, then the bound states are like tables and chairs and heavy things. Right? So these are, three levels. So let's see that again. So you have some ground state, you have some excitations, and then you have some bound state of these excitations. So if you already believe in emergence, right? So if you were nodding during Belloc's talk, then this is nothing. This is just nothing new. This is just how the world will be, right? If you believe that essentially we are living in some sort of large, in some large quantum system, then this is what that means. So you have some ground state, you have some excitations, which we call elementary particles, and the bound states are these classical big objects around us. So that's the overview. Now, how could that have anything to do with gravity? So let me tell you how that is. So the first part of the argument is to realize the following thing. If you have a vacuum, so let's say there's none of these big, large objects around, then your vacuum will be characterized by this theta zero. But if you take one of these bound states, then what will happen is that since it's made out of excitations, and excitations are nothing else but deviations of the vacuum from this theta zero value, we will see that it follows that the theta here around this object cannot be the vacuum value. That's the key point. So now what follows from that? What follows from that is what I would argue is something that we call Newton's law. So how does that go? So in the energy describing the system, you will always have a term like this one, which is the term that is responsible for the propagation of these modes. Right? So this is a term that wants to remove any sort of deviation of theta from this theta zero value. Right, so there's always some term like that. So if you vary that with theta, then you can find the equation satisfied by theta, and this is the Laplace equation. And then I want to ask you the following thing. Imagine instead of theta, imagine you are in first semester electrostatics, and you replace theta with u, then you immediately realize you recognize what these equations are. So I'm basically now just concerned with a basically static case, right? So nothing's moving, these things are just sitting there, and I want to know, is there a force between them or not? So if you just replace theta by u, then these equations are the equations of electrostatics, and you know that there will be a force between them, which is given by this. So this is this r squared here is just follows just from the Laplace equation, and the masses here are just given by this expression, which is if you make this replacement, this would be something like the electric field. So this would be like the charge in the analogy with the thing. So the point is that if you have such big large bound objects, because they are made out of these excitations, they cannot do anything but attract each other. If you put one in the vacuum, then another one will know about the presence of that thing. So my claim is that this is the origin of gravity. So to recapitulate, So internal relativity is the question of what does the system look from the inside. So if you have if your bound state dynamics is described by something like Maxwell's equation, then you will find a Lorentzian metric. So all you need for that is some constant speed of light. And I just argued sort of for the first step towards gravity, which is the Newtonian gravity part, which means that if you do this correctly, this inside look, naturally the metric will be curved. Right, which is, this is very interesting. I mean, these systems that I started out with, there's no curvature, there's no geometry, there's no nothing, but the inside geometry will naturally be curved. Okay, so now let's come to the discussion. So this is sort of one thing that I want to point out. This is sort of the decision you have to make on the way to quantum gravity, right? So either you think that geometry is fundamental and matter is somehow on that, or you think matter and geometry are both emergent. So let's first look at this part here. So if you think that matter is on geometry, then your point of view is basically that space-time is fundamental, Einstein's equations are fundamental. You really care about a quantum theory of that. So you want to construct something like A2 of geometries, and what you will be doing is new quantum gravity and spin forms and things like that. Right? So if, on the other hand, you take this road, then you don't think that space-time is fundamental, it's emergent. Matter emerges sort of as its dual partner. The Einstein equations will be derived, the equivalence principle is derived, and you will do something what I call internal relativity. So now I'm just going to make a couple of remarks of different sort of importance. So why is this possible? Why can I do this? The reason why I can do this is because matter and geometry both emerge. So the notion of geometry that I have in the fundamental model is a completely different one than I have from the emergent one. And it's because of that that they're free to influence each other. Another thing is that sort of emergence is really important because in my argument I use two levels of emergence. Two. And this is sort of a very important remark maybe in this community, and it was also done by Baylock this morning, which is that it's actually important to solve the model to actually see what the physics is of the emergent physics. And it's sort of, I mean, that's sort of just a remark at the new quantum gravity community. It's a sort of, nobody seems to be trying to actually solve the model, right? You write down some path integral, you write down some constraint, but nobody solves it. Nobody does. So the only exception is Daniele, right? Daniele, I think, is the only person who actually tries to look at this thing, take it seriously, and go for the next step. Right? What is the emergent stuff? Okay, so what is important? Then another point which is kind of interesting because it sheds my point of view sheds new light on this problem of time. So the problem of time is that we don't know what to do with this equation, right? With the in relativity, in canonical relativity, the evolution is purely constrained. So what to do with that? And so if you believe my point, then you see that this problem arises because of an unphysical idealization. Right? So in my point of view, what you have is you have matter and geometry arising both at the same time, and their relation is described by Einstein's equation. But then what you do is you throw away one part, which you shouldn't be allowed to do. You just throw it away. And it's because of that you run into these problems. So it's perfectly fine to have an external time. You just have to make sure that you don't use that in your internal description. So a short remark on the cosmological constant problem. If you don't have this matter on geometry problem, then you also have no cosmological constant problem as it is usually formulated. So let me just sort of leave it here at this sort of sketch. I wrote this up in this paper. So one question, which is sort of very interesting to think about, is this an ether theory, which is sort of a bad word, right? You're just doing an ether theory. But the point is this, that if you look at the original meaning of ether, it was very different from what I'm doing. Because in the original meaning, the ether was just a something that was carrying electromagnetic waves. was just there for that. And on top of that, you had the matter. So the matter had nothing to do with the ether. The matter was sort of, it was like I don't know, swimming on a lake or something like. But the lake was there for the waves, but the matter was some I don't know, some duck or something else that had nothing to do with it. And here it's very different, because all of matter, radiation, particles, everything, is just excitations of the model. And that makes all the difference. Another remark is on the Lorentz group. So the current understanding is that the Lorentz group is something fundamental, right? So for example, if you take Weinberg's quantum field theory book, the first chapter is on the representation theory of the Poincaré group. And the reason is that he identifies elementary particles with representations, irreducible representation of the Poincaré group. And here it's exactly the other way around. It's the particles that define the symmetry. So I would advocate that the Lorentz group has nothing to do in the fundamental setup of your theory. Another short remark on quantum mechanics. So in another paper that I should have cited here, I argue that classical objects are like these big bound objects that I argued before. So if what I said is true, then what this implies is that classicality implies curvature. So if you want to be sort of glib, then Maxwell's equations give you Minkowski space, but if you sort of really think about quantum mechanics, you get GR. Another thing on quantization. So the way when you quantize a system, what you basically believe is that this circle is closed, right? So you take the fundamental theory, you take the classical limit, you arrive at the classical theory, and then if you quantize that, you arrive back at the fundamental theory, right? I always found this very weird, right? Because the less fundamental theory seems to be prior to the more fundamental theory. So in any case, if what I say is correct, then this circle does not close. The quantization of gravity does not give you the whatever fundamental theory it is. So the point is, and I think a lot of people are doing this already, starting with Baylock and Fotini, is that you start with the quantum theory, right? The basic blocks of your theory have no meaning of a metric or what have you. Like you start with the quantum theory, pure and simple, and then you discover what the meaning of these things is. Observable effects. I'm almost done, Chairman. this was already discussed by Fotini. The first thing is the cosmology part. So the question is, since I have all these levels, you could ask, well, what if these levels emerge in some sort of phase transition, what would it look like? If I am sort of, there's a phase transition and then billions of years later, I am living in that space created by that phase transition. How does that phase transition look from my point of view? Right? That's a cool question. That's a cool question that you can ask, and I don't know the answer to that yet. Another thing is that all fundamental constants, the things that we call fundamental, like the gravitational constant H bar, C, all of these things can be in principle expressed in terms of the fundamental theory, right? So there are some parameters in the fundamental theory, and they should give you these fundamental constants. And the point is that there could be relations between them, right, that we just see as a complete coincidence now, but in fact they are prescribed. And I just want to hint at something. This is something that I'm just going to throw it out. It's not quite, I didn't quite nail this down, but so just take it as something how it could look like. Right? So the question could be that is G automatically one, since I'm not really putting in any units. And in fact, I think what I can show is that G is naturally small. So if one compares sort of if one takes two small objects and one compares their interaction to the gravitational interaction, then I can write down some equation like that, where n is sort of the number of constituents that make up the next level, right? So n is something like the number of at least the number of constituents of atoms in this table. So the point is that this n will be much larger than one. So naturally, in this thing, G would be small. So by things like that, one could hope. So take this just as a sort of a hope. So eternal relativity could, for example, shed light on what we call the hierarchy problem. Why is gravity so weak? I think that's it. Yes. Thanks.
So, I had a question about the motivation. So, if you are considering a theory in which the universe is fundamental, or even that there's not really any causal structure at the outset, then what's the motivation for considering a quantum theory at all? Because now the implications of the Bell theorem are defined. So, it would be interesting just to use classical theory.
Why?
Well, because one of the big reasons that there's nothing stopping you from using classical theory.
Well, but I still at some level I have to find quantum mechanics, right? Well, if you want to go that route, you feel free to do it. I think it adds sort of another layer of complication that I don't need. But the point is that I'm thinking the exact opposite way, right? Because what I want to know is why is there classical stuff arising from quantum stuff? So. But I mean, yes, you're right. I mean, if you want, you can do that, I guess. I mean, in some sense, that's Lee's and Fortini's point in their paper. So I guess that quantum mechanics could be a fact of sort of non-trivial space-time at a Planck level, if you want. Yes, sure, okay. Yeah, it's just not my route. Yeah.
Thank you. As I understood it, part of your argument when you're looking at some non-state and excited states on it, and you said gyro mirrors, because you put two blobs that consist of excited states in the excited trap. So are you saying that you cannot really use repulsive forces like the geometrism within the machine?
No, I mean, this is gravity, right? So the repulsive forces are on top of that, right? I mean, the stuff is made out of something that holds together for a reason.
Okay, so whatever forces you have, you always have something else to
do. Yes, that's a point. That's a point.
Okay, so then, for the presentation, we'll do a thing called security.